I call this meeting of the Committee on Public Safety, Finance, and Policy to order. We do have a quorum. Just a few things to mention before we get started. Everyone today must be seated in the hearing room. There's no standing or sitting in the walkways or aisles. If you need further accommodation, please let staff know. Signs are not permitted in the hearing room or at the testifiers' table. Please leave signs outside. Clapping and other disruptions are not allowed. And all testifiers who've signed up in advance have been provided with a time limit. Please adhere to these limits, and members of the public, if you wish to testify, will also have a time limit. And we do this just to keep things moving so we can get to full member discussion on bills and take votes. So we're not trying to be rude. We're just trying to keep things moving in our allotted time. The first order of business is to approve last meeting's minutes. Chair Becker Finn, may I have a motion to approve the minutes for March 14, 2024?
So moved, Madam Chair.
Chair Becker Finn moves approval of the minutes for March 14, 2024. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed? The motion prevails and the minutes for March 14, 2024 are approved. The first bill on today's agenda is House File 4043. This is a Representative Adbaje bill. Welcome to the back to the committee, Representative. Please go ahead and tell us about your bill. I don't see any amendments, and I will just say that I move that House File 4043 be re-referred to the Committee on State and Local Government Finance and Policy. Please go ahead.
Thank you, Madam Chair and committee members. So today I'm presenting House File 4043, also known as the Prison Gerrymandering Reform Bill. Prison gerrymandering is an unfortunate flaw in our census collection system that over time has led to imbalances in the population count. When the census first began, the main concern was the relative population between states, as that data was used to determine the representation in the U.S. House of Representatives. As the United States grew, states started using the census population to determine local jurisdictions and their state-level representation. This meant that jurisdictions that contained prisons could count incarcerated persons as residents and attain a boost in representation based on imbalanced numbers, without the participation of the incarcerated people in the community of the prison. It meant that the home communities where prisoners had come from would lose their portion of political power in the state based on population. While the Census Bureau has not yet decided to act on this, states are using their power to reallocate the data that comes from the census every 10 years to ensure a more accurate count. This bill lays out that for the 2030 census and beyond, the Minnesota Department of Corrections and the Legislative Coordinating Commission will begin to reallocate incarcerated persons in state and federal prisons to the census blocks where they came from rather than the jurisdiction of the prison. The Department of Corrections will collect the addresses of the incarcerated persons immediately prior to incarceration, then send that data to the LCC. The LCC will then reallocate the known address of each incarcerated person to the census block of their home community. This is important because most incarcerated people do not reside in the communities where the prison is located, and once released, will return to the place where they were arrested. And according to Minnesota's Department of Corrections data, that's up to close to 95% of people. The data collected will closely track the census categories so that the LCC can properly reallocate people to the census block where they came from. And for those without a last known address, an address outside of the state, or who do not wish to provide an address, the incarcerated person will be included in the statewide count. By starting now, we can prepare for the 2030 census and ensure that Minnesotans are being counted and represented fairly. And with that, I'll turn it over to testifiers to take any questions.
Thank you. And I believe you have one testifier, Carmen Allen. Come on forward. And you can introduce yourself and begin your testimony. Welcome.
Thank you. Hello, committee. My name is Carmen Allen, and I am an organizer with the New Justice Project. I am here to share my support to end of prison gerrymandering. My organization is member-led, made up of leaders from across the Twin Cities. Many of our members who are newly incarcerated or newly released from incarceration or have been out for many years. We voted as an organization to support this issue because our leaders told us that while incarcerated, they wanted to be counted from their home, not the prison that they were detained to. Prison gerrymandering exasperates the injustices by counting incarcerated individuals as residents. of the present location for the purpose of legislation representation. This artificially inflates the population of certain districts, giving undue political influence to areas where prisons are located while diluting the voting power of communities from which incarcerated individuals actually come. So having seen the criminal justice system myself through our membership, I've firsthand seen the dehumanizing effects of incarceration. But what I found equally troubling, was the way our electoral process further marginalized individuals like my membership, turning us into mere statistics rather than citizens with voices deserving to be heard. Thank you for your time.
Thank you for your testimony. And I don't know that you have other testifiers signed up.
No, I don't, but there are others in the room to answer more technical questions.
Okay, great. So we'll call first to see if there's any members of the public who wish to testify on the bill. I am not seeing any, so we can move on to member discussion. Any member discussion? Representative Hudson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I was hoping somebody else would go first so I could collect my thoughts. Where is this ultimately heading? Like, what's the end goal of the trajectory of refiguring how we allocate political representation?
Representative Agbaje.
Madam Chair, Representative Hudson, I think right now the goal is really just to ensure that people are being counted in their appropriate communities.
Representative Hudson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you, Representative Agbaje. So, you know, we're talking about people who have been convicted of crimes beyond a reasonable doubt. They're sentenced to prison. Their residency changes from wherever it was to where they're incarcerated. Is there any reason to believe that, well, maybe that's the wrong way to ask the question. Why should their political representation be tied to where they were as opposed to where they currently are? I'm just trying to understand what the rationale is there.
Representative Agbaje.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you, Representative Hudson. You actually brought up a good point. So according to Article 7, Section 2 of the Minnesota Constitution, your residency actually does not change based on incarceration. So you actually should be counted based on where you last were. It's similar to those who are serving in our armed forces or contained in another type of state facility. And so this is actually something that a lot of states have, that your residency doesn't change upon incarceration. And so the fact that states were counting people incorrectly is something that they're just trying to rectify now.
Representative Hudson.
Thank you for that clarification.
All right, Representative Hollins.
Thank you, Chair Mueller. Thank you, Representative Agbaje, for bringing this bill forward. I am curious if we know approximately how many people in the state of Minnesota are being miscounted because of this gerrymandering.
Representative Agbaje.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you, Representative Hollins. I don't think I have that number off the top of my head. I'm not sure if someone from DOC does, but that's information we can get back to you and to the rest of the committee. But it is my understanding that the way outside of about the 12 or 14 states that have redone their reallocation, that every person who is incarcerated is likely being counted in the wrong jurisdiction.
Representative Hollins.
Thank you. And so one technical question, would this also apply to people who are, say, sentenced to lifetime imprisonment?
Representative Agbaje.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Yes, it still would, as long as they had an address that was somewhere else. We just want to ensure that everyone's being counted properly. And then if they don't have an address, it just goes to the statewide count for Minnesota. Yeah.
Okay. Representative Hollins.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And thank you, Representative Agbaje. Yeah, I'm definitely in favor of this. I mean, I think this is what we would call fairness. You know, we know that historically certain communities have been over-policed and therefore are over-represented in our prison system, which means that they are then counted incorrectly for you know, the areas that they actually represent, where they have families, where they had businesses, and where they were engaged politically. And so to me, it makes sense to make sure that they are being counted towards those areas for just basic fairness. So thank you for bringing this forward. I'm in support of the bill.
All right. Further? Lead Novotny.
Chair Mueller. Representative
Agbaje.
I'm very filled up with phlegm today, so excuse the. College kids, are they counted in the census where they go to college or where they live?
Representative Agbaje.
Madam Chair, yes. So college students, they have the choice really to actually be counted whether at their university or at home. Actually, a number of college students, their parents actually do claim them at the home when the census comes around every 10 years to say that they are a resident of their home with their parents.
Representative Novotny.
Thank you, Chair. So then can they vote in both places or either one of the places?
Representative Agbaje.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you, Representative Novotny. They are only able to vote in one location, so they would have to vote in one place. But the census does not deal with voting. It just deals with the count to understand the distribution of representation.
Representative Novotny.
So is this going to lead to voting in the prisons or?
Well, I'll just say that this bill doesn't have anything to do with voting, so it has to do with the census.
I understand that, Chair. Thank you.
All right. Well, usually we call on, all right, Representative Ingen.
Sorry, Chair Mueller. Thank you. And thank you, Representative Agbaje. I just have one question here. So it has some stats here that I was looking up. 65% of the state's incarcerated population by court records, they have that known address. And in those cases where they don't, it asks of self-reporting. Is there any way of verifying that that's actually the case, that the address that they're claiming is to their home community?
Representative Agbaje.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you, Representative Ingen. Yes, so self-reporting is what happens also during the census. So basically, if you fill out the census form, you are self-reporting that you live at that address. Similarly, if a census worker comes to you, you're attesting that you live at that address. We have data clauses in the bill that discuss that the address that they provide, the LCC would then work to ensure that it is actually a valid address. And if it is within the confines of the data parameters that they've created, if that address is valid, then it will be self-attested to the incarcerated person that that's where they lived.
All right, and don't see any other member comments, so go ahead with your closing remarks.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you, committee members. I appreciate your time today, and I encourage you to support this bill so that we can continue to address the fairness situation in Minnesota and that every person is counted where they belong.
Thank you. I renew the motion that House File 4043 be re-referred to the Committee on State and Local Government Finance and Policy. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? The motion prevails. Next up, we have Representative Norris, House File 3799. We are going to be laying this bill over, so I will move to lay over House File 3799. Representative Norris, welcome back to the committee. Please explain your bill.
Thank you, Chair Mueller and members. It's great to be with you. I'm pleased to introduce House File 3799. This bill will create an Office of Animal Protection under the Department of Public Safety. Animal cruelty is an ongoing concern in Minnesota, but the tools for education, training, and enforcement throughout the state are inconsistent. While some communities have expertise and resources to tackle these crimes, many do not. The purpose of this office is to provide a more comprehensive approach to prevent and respond to the crime of animal cruelty. We've all heard of serial killers torturing animals before going after people, but animal cruelty is also linked to more common crimes such as child abuse, domestic violence, and elder abuse. This office will address the crime of animal cruelty and its link to human violence. The office will not take over, but instead will assist local authorities in the enforcement of animal cruelty laws. The office will also include an advisory council, as well as a director to guide its efforts. It will take a multidisciplinary approach, providing expertise and training for investigations, prosecution, veterinary forensics, animal care, and human welfare as it relates to cruelty. The duties of this office also include building partnerships and collaborations statewide, gathering and analyzing crime data, and allowing for grants to help prevent cruelty. Importantly, this bill does not make any changes to the definitions of animal or animal cruelty that are already established in state statute. The work needs to begin to understand and respond to these crimes and protect the public's peace, health, and safety for all animals and people.
Thank you,
Chair Mueller.
Yep, thank you. And I believe that you have a couple of testifiers here.
Yes, I do.
All right, first we have James Backstrom, retired Dakota County Attorney. It's been a while. Good to see you. Please introduce yourself and begin.
Thank you, Madam Chair and committee members. It's an honor to be here again. It's been a little while, as you said. I had the privilege and honor of serving as a Dakota County Attorney for 33 years before I retired in February of 2021. I also served as a member of the Board of Directors of the Minnesota County Attorneys Association for 31 years and as a board member on the National District Attorneys Association for 28 years. During my career, my office prosecuted many cases of animal cruelty, from a single animal being hurt and abused to hundreds of animals being neglected or abused. These are serious issues that need to be appropriately addressed by our criminal justice system. Violence in the form of animal cruelty can lead to is often associated with other types of crimes, as Representative Norris indicated. Domestic violence being one of the prevalent ones, but many others as well. If this is ignored, such violence can continue and become more severe. I support this bill because it will create an office that will build and help build the expertise and resources needed to effectively respond to these serious crimes. I believe it's important for the statewide agency to be under the Minnesota Bureau of Criminal Apprehension and the Department of Public Safety. You know, that agency, the BCA, is one that I had the privilege of working with for many, many years. It's one of the best investigative agencies, not just in our state, but in our nation. Animal cruelty crimes can often be complex. Cities and counties need a qualified source to call upon to help share information and knowledge and experience on animal law, investigations, and prosecution. Training is essential in this area for effective enforcement, and the Office of Animal Protection will provide that critical training. Crime data and prevention measures are also needed to help stop these crimes before they occur. The Office of Animal Protection will be able to help identify these crimes and support criminal investigations of animal cruelty throughout our state and lead prevention efforts in this important area. This bill, this office, if it's created, will help our state's law enforcement agencies and prosecutors in their efforts to pursue these serious crimes of violence, and in doing so, protect not only these defenseless animals, but the people in our state as well. So thank you for the opportunity to be here today and to testify in support of this important bill. Thank you.
Thank you. Next, we have Reese Fredrickson.
Chair Mueller, that testifier is coming from Greater Minnesota and hasn't arrived yet, so I'd recommend moving forward if he does arrive and it's time permitting, we could have him testify, but I think best to just move forward at this point.
Yep, that sounds good, and we are laying this bill over, so we would have the opportunity to do that. Let's see, anybody else from the public who wishes to testify? We had one person sign up, Jenna Washi. Yep, come on down. Welcome to the committee. Please introduce yourself and begin your testimony.
Thank you, Madam Chair and Representatives. Pleasure to be here. My name is Jenna Washi. Lieutenant Michael Fry and I co-wrote the original Office of Animal Protection Bill, House File 1850, that was introduced in February of 2023. We worked together as civilian and sworn partners for many years to investigate animal crimes and cruelty in the city of Minneapolis. There are unique skill sets and knowledge needed to successfully investigate these types of crimes. This direct experience with crime victims and those impacted by these crimes showed us the gap in statewide animal cruelty enforcement. We wrote the original Office of Animal Protection Bill to fill that gap. The original bill focuses on crimes related to household pets in Minnesota and provides for the directed enforcement of laws utilizing law enforcement officers of animal protection, similar to how DNR officers enforce wildlife laws. Livestock and agricultural animal laws are enforced by the Board of Animal Health, so this would not create overlap or redundancy. We took the time to meet with and gather input from stakeholders in this field to ensure that this bill would meet the needs of the state and provide enforcement for the existing animal cruelty laws. House File 3799 is very similar to the Companion Animal Board Bill, as it does not include any enforcement capabilities. It only puts in place an additional advisory function limited to providing guidance on animal topics. This bill causes redundancy by overlapping with multiple other departments and divisions already tasked with regulating wildlife, livestock, and others. It will cause confusion for both the public and these entities. Minnesota is long overdue for a statewide agency with the capabilities to enforce animal cruelty laws and provide the support needed for those negatively impacted by these crimes. House File 3799 does not meet that need. I encourage you to support the original Office of Animal Protection Bill, House File 1850, and vote no on House File 3799 today. Thank you for your time.
Thanks for your testimony. Anybody else from the public who wishes to testify on this?
Chair Mueller, I believe our second testifier actually just arrived.
Okay, great. Come on down. Good timing. We appreciate you driving here. Welcome to the committee. You please introduce yourself.
Good morning, Madam Chair. My name is Reese Fredrickson. I've served as the Pine County Attorney for the last 10 years. I've been a prosecutor for over 16 years. I am currently a member of the Animal Cruelty Advisory Council for the Association of Prosecuting Attorneys, and I'm co-author of the Animal Cruelty Chapter for the Minnesota Judges Criminal Bench Book. My county is in a rural area, but we've seen all types of crimes involving animals, from intentional abuse to organized animal abuse such as cockfighting, to neglect to animal sexual abuse. And this has been for all animals. In nearly every animal cruelty case I've prosecuted, I've seen offenders who have also committed acts of child abuse, vulnerable adult abuse, criminal sexual conduct, and domestic violence. Animal cruelty crimes are often a precursor to or interrelated with these other types of crimes. Communities need assistance with animal cruelty crimes, including expertise, legal, financial, and where to find resources. I believe this office will provide it. Animal cruelty crimes are not rare. In my experience, I found that they often do not get reported, or there's confusion on who to report it to. Once a crime is reported to law enforcement, additional resources are typically needed to carry the case through to a successful conclusion. Those resources include training on how to collect evidence, where to place animals once they are seized, how the seizure process works, advice for prosecutors such as sentencing possibilities, psychological rehabilitative services, and prosecution strategies. The Minnesota legislature has always supported animal protection. First animal cruelty law in Minnesota was passed before statehood. This bill recognizes what the state has known for over a century, that animal cruelty must be taken seriously. This office will work to build resources to help those tasked to enforce the law. So I strongly support HF 3799, create an Office of Animal Protection. I thank you for your time.
Thanks for your testimony. All right, we'll move on now to member discussion. Representative Hudson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you, Representative Norris, for carrying this bill. I've spoken to folks who support it, and the way it was presented to me is something that it's a need that I think does need to be filled in terms of just making sure that the laws that we have on the books are being enforced and that folks know how to respond to these complaints. My concern, I think, was fleshed out by the public testifier, who I'm grateful for, of potential unintended consequences of the way this is currently drafted. My question is, can you tell me what it is you're trying to achieve in 5.3 through 5.25 with the inclusion of the prevention of cruelty to animals chapter in crimes of violence?
Representative Norris.
Chair Mueller and Representative Hudson, appreciate the question. I think what we're trying to accomplish in that section of the bill is to treat animal cruelty like what it is. It is a crime of violence. I think in the testimony we've heard today and some of the materials you have in your member packet, the link Well, first of all, there's the violence that can occur to the animal itself, but then also the strong link to human violence warrants this crime being treated as a crime of violence under our state statutory scheme.
Representative Hudson.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you, Representative Norris. What does that mean in terms of how it's prosecuted?
Representative Norris.
Chair Mueller, Representative Hudson, perhaps nonpartisan staff might be better equipped to go into the nuances of you know what a crime of violence brings in terms of how cases are prosecuted. Needless to say, this is a collection of crimes that the state of Minnesota has deemed to be connected to violence, and therefore, given the connection animal cruelty to violence, it seems appropriate that it be in the crime of violence collection of crimes under our state statutory scheme.
Representative Hudson.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you, Representative Norris. I must confess to having not read through Chapter 343 recently, but just looking at some of the chapter titles and comparing them to what we consider to be crimes of violence. I mean, under crimes of violence, we have things such as murder, manslaughter, aiding and suicide, which is interesting, assault in various forms, robbery, carjacking, things that I think uncontestably qualify as violence. But then when you move over to the cruelty of animals, chapter 343, we're looking at things like docking horses, injury to birds, artificially colored animals. And again, having not recently looked into the details of what these things are, I'm just wondering to what extent these crimes deserve to be on the same level as the current crimes of violence. Would you be willing to speak to that?
Yep, Representative Norris.
Yeah. Chair Mueller, Representative Hudson, you've cited a couple of examples from a pretty extensive list that runs about 22 lines long in the statute of what constitutes a crime of violence. I think some have probably a clearer connection to violence. There are some in here that might have less of a direct connection to actual physical violence. But what I would say is that when you look overall, this notion of animal cruelty, these are oftentimes crimes of violence. And just because the violence is occurring to an animal rather than a human, I don't think there should be a distinction under our statutory scheme that would distinguish between those two, especially given the strong link between the animal violence and the human violence as well.
Representative Hudson.
Madam Chair, in conclusion, can I inquire of nonpartisan staff what the impact of including this chapter in crimes of violence would be in terms of prosecution?
Ben Johnson.
Madam Chair, Representative Hudson and members, as a first note, this crime of violence definition only applies to felony convictions, so if any of the crimes that you mentioned are not felony offenses, they would not fall under that particular definition. This is the crime of violence definition that is in 624.712. That's the firearm chapter. So the direct impact of this is that someone who is convicted of a felony level offense that's a violation of chapter 343 would be prohibited from owning or possessing a firearm. There are multiple other places throughout statutes that have incorporated this particular definition, but it does not change how a particular offense is prosecuted. The immediate impact is the person would be prohibited from possessing a firearm.
Representative Hudson.
Thank you very much for that clarification, and thank you, Representative Norris, for your answers.
Representative Kern.
Thank you, Chair. And I don't need a lengthy response to this. I just wanted to, it came up a little bit earlier that we do have a way to address this currently in statute with the Minnesota, the Federation of Humane Societies. And if we could just, if you could give a brief, maybe why we would need to create this office versus expand or fund what we currently have.
Mm-hmm. Representative Norris.
Yeah, Chair Mueller, Representative Curran, this office is designed to take a little bit more comprehensive approach in terms of training, tools, and resources. There's five different disciplines that are outlined in the bill, including things, I believe, like forensic veterinary medicine. This is a broad issue, and we feel like it's best tackled by, you know, having a dedicated office that can bring together all those different disciplines under one roof.
Representative Whitty.
Thank you, Chair Mueller. Thank you, Representative Norris, for bringing this forward. And, you know, I was I had some people in my office, and I was very interested in this because I know these are incidents when we get them on the street that don't happen very often but can be very complex. So I like the idea of the resource. I was a little confused by the testifiers. I agree with former county attorney Backstrom that these are very complicated cases and the investigation tools and all that. So is this office, and a lot of times out in our cities and our counties, these are non-licensed officers doing the investigation of the crime. So in the BCA, will there be a licensed officer that will be able to help and bring charges and all that and bring that resource to it?
Mm-hmm. Representative Norris.
Chair Mueller, Representative Whitty, for right now, the office under this bill is starting pretty small. It contemplates hiring a director. You know, our belief is that with the $350,000 appropriated, they might be able to hire a second kind of more administrative person. So probably not immediately, but the goal is that over time, that additional resources would be able to be added to the office, and I can imagine part of the idea of placing it within the Department of Public Safety is that you could have sworn officers who could help local jurisdictions carry out those sorts of tasks.
Representative Woody.
Thank you. Yeah, my suggestion would be they can get trained, they can be that resource, but I do agree that these are very complicated cases to maneuver, and if the goal is to ultimately hold the people accountable, that might be an area that you might we could look at sooner than later. Thank you.
Great. Thank you.
Chair Beckerfin.
Thanks, Chair Mueller. And just wanted to point out one of the felony level offenses within Chapter 343 is about dogfighting, and we do know there's a connection between dogfighting and gang activity and drugs and other criminal activity. So just wanted to bring that up as one of the felony level offenses that would fall under Chapter 343 on the crime of violence side. So I think that is important because, you know, we've already touched on the domestic violence and the other abusive things that happen that are connected with cruelty to animals, but that one hadn't been mentioned. So just wanted to note that for the record.
Thank you. We always appreciate your attention to the words on the page. Thank you. Representative Mueller.
Thank you, Chair Mueller and Representative Norris. Like many of my colleagues, when this was presented to me, definitely has all the elements of making sure that we're protecting our animals and all of the linkage that we've been presented with. I did just have one question about Section 4, about the advisory committee. Most of the time when we look at advisory committees, there is actual stated people that will be, you know, appointed or things like that, and this is left blank, and so all it says is that committee members shall possess knowledge, skills, or experiences of the prevention, investigation, or prosecution of animal cruelty, on and on and on. And so can you give us flesh any of that out right now so we kind of know what that is and what that advisory committee would look like?
Mm-hmm. Representative Norris.
Chair Mueller, Representative Mueller, we didn't want to be overly prescriptive in terms of outlining who is on this advisory committee. You're right that, you know, we take kind of different approaches sometimes in statute. Occasionally, it's more open-ended like this bill is. In other cases, it's more prescriptive where we say it shall have 15 members and one shall be from this and another shall be from that. Certainly open to suggestions. This bill is being laid over. If there are certain types of individuals, if there's additional experiences that you'd like to see represented on that advisory committee, I'm certainly happy to have that conversation, and we could look at adding that to the bill if it decides, or if the chair and the committee ultimately decide to have it go forward.
Representative Mueller. Oh, no, I couldn't tell if that was a hand raise or that was a stop.
That was okay. Push the mic back.
All right. Yeah. It's good I'm not like an auctioneer. I'm really bad at like figuring out what this
now
is.
I'm buying.
Yeah, exactly. Representative Grassel.
Again, just going off of Rep. Mueller's, how many members?
would be on this committee, and because I see there's they would be getting a per diem and expenses.
Representative Norris.
Chair Mueller, I'm just double checking here. I don't think that the bill actually specifies the exact number of members of the committee. And somebody correct me if they're seeing it elsewhere, but I don't think it does. That's
yeah. Anything further?
Might be something that be kind of important.
All right, Representative Ingen.
Thank you, Chair Mueller, and thank you, Representative Norris. I know we talked on the phone yesterday. We had some questions on this. Definitely in support of the overall goal here. I think there is a really strong link between animal cruelty and crimes of violence. We see that often, and you know, giving more resources so we can actually prosecute this crime, find it, go after it, that's a good thing. One of the questions I do have, and I know I brought it up yesterday, but with this advisory committee, it's pretty open-ended. It doesn't seem like there's a whole lot of definitions or direct guidance as to what the makeup of that advisory committee would look like. I don't know about you guys. I had bacon for breakfast this morning. That in and of itself could present a question to an advisory committee when I saw a post also when I was looking it up while eating my bacon that PETA says that it's unreasonable and unjustified that we're killing animals and eating them. Could that potentially open the door for some really kind of not the intended goal of addressing animal cruelty? Could you speak to that a little bit?
Representative Morris.
Yeah, Chair Mueller and Representative Engen, appreciate the question and appreciate the phone conversation we were able to have yesterday. You know, certainly on the advisory committee, there could be a wide range of perspectives, and I would actually hope that there would be a wide range of perspectives on the advisory committee. I think that's the role that an advisory committee should play in the process. Regardless of what views are represented on that advisory committee, to the extent that we're worried about enforcement actions, those enforcement actions can only be taken by the local county attorney. This office does not have the authority to prosecute individuals under the animal cruelty statutes. I envision this advisory committee as a place to have robust discussion about how can we best provide the tools, the training, and the resources needed to prevent animal cruelty, and if it does occur to help with enforcement. But in terms of actual enforcement actions, that would always sit at the local level with the local county attorney.
All right. Any further member discussion? Lead Nabotny.
Thank you, Chair Mueller. Representative Norris, have you been in contact with the Humane Society? Maybe I missed this in your presentation. Mm-hmm. Have you been in contact with them? They already have investigation and enforcement mm-hmm. authority in this mm-hmm. state. How do they feel about this? Mm-hmm.
Representative Norris.
Chair Mueller, Lead Novotny, they stopped by my office and had just a brief conversation a while back. I think that was also when the bill was in a very different form. I have not heard from them since.
Lead Novotny.
Thank you, Chair. Representative Norris, I'll touch base with you afterwards on this, but I think we're – my concern when I read this bill to start with is that we're kind of reinventing the wheel and you know, one person in the state the size of Minnesota won't really make that much difference when we have a fairly robust statute on animal cruelty already, and we've got systems. Every municipality must have some sort of animal control investigative unit, and we have, you know, I've worked with the Humane Society on investigations, one of the pretty high-profile dogfighting case. You know, they have pretty good experts. My concern is we're just reinventing the wheel. That's my position. Thank you, Chair.
Any closing remarks, Representative Norris?
Yeah, Chair Mueller, and appreciate the conversation we've had here with the committee. Overall, I think this is a good step forward in terms of tackling the issue of animal cruelty in our state. It's focused on providing that training, the tools, and the resources. I think one of the things that I really appreciate about this approach is the emphasis that there would be in the resources to help with the training and prevention so that we head these cases off before there's even a need for investigation and enforcement. Appreciate the committee hearing it and entertaining it for possible inclusion in the omnibus.
Thank you so much for presenting the bill, for the good discussion for members today. And I renew my motion and lay over House File 3799. The next bill up is House File 4591. It is the Representative Tabke bill. And Representative Tabke, I believe that your motion is that House File 4591 be placed on the general register. Is that correct?
Thank you, Madam Chair. Yes, that is my motion.
All right, and there are no amendments, so please go ahead and tell us about your bill.
All right, thank you very much, Madam Chair and members. So last November, Care 11 and AJ The Go published the results of a nationwide investigation that exposed widespread sexual assault by private contractors. First, before we get too far into this, I just want to make sure everyone knows and who everyone in the room or watching is aware that we will be talking about rape and sexual violence during this bill. So just so everyone is aware that that is part of what we'll be discussing today. So the investigation exposed widespread sexual assault by private contractors in the business of transporting inmates and pretrial detainees. In part, it told the harrowing story of Danielle Civils, who was repeatedly sexually assaulted by a private contractor working for the company Inmate Services Corporation while being extradited from Texas to St. Paul in an out-of-state warrant for probation violations in 2019. Ramsey County had contracted with ICSC to perform this extradition. So under Minnesota law, the Board of Private Detective and Protective Agent Services is tasked with licensing companies that provide private security, including companies like ISC that perform prisoner transports. And while most of these companies already go through the proper licensing procedures, the investigation found that several companies that Hennepin, Ramsey, and others have contracted with are not and have never been licensed by the board. And so that means that Hennepin and Ramsey counties have been entrusted prisoners in their custody to unlicensed private security contractors. And I just want to play a little bit of from the clip. And so the audio is very quiet in this room, so if everyone could stay quiet, I would appreciate it.
In federal court records, she's listed by her initials, DD.
I've never said anything to anyone.
Those records spell out what Gabrielle Dixon has never spoken about publicly until now.
The strength and the traumatizing of it.
A violent sexual assault in a rest stop bathroom.
The hurt from it is just building up when you don't have nobody to talk to.
Her accused rapist, Marquette Johnson, a guard for Inmate Services Corporation. ISC is a private company paid tax dollars to transport prisoners across the country. CARE's investigation has today tied just that one company and its guards to 21 sex assault allegations where there's already been a lawsuit, criminal charges, or conviction.
It's horrifying but not surprising, and it shows a real need for additional investigation and action to protect people who are being transported between jails and prisons.
And so that, Madam Chair, is what we're working on doing today. So there is a very much a need for this. This already exists under rule in Minnesota that they must be licensed in order to transport prisoners. But there are many folks who are denying the fact that is in fact the case. And so we are codifying that today to make sure we're working on codifying that today to make sure that it is in statute so that anyone who is transporting prisoners is included under Minnesota law and needs to be licensed. And Madam Chair, we have to testify today is the chair of the Minnesota Board of Private Detectives, Rick Hodston.
All right, if you want to come on forward, Chair Rick Hodston, and you please introduce yourself for the record, and you can begin your testimony. Welcome.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. As indicated, my name is Rick Hodston, or as my 97-and-a-half-year-old mother would call me, Richard Dwayne Hodston. But I am the chair of the board. I have served on the board for quite some time. Our board consists of five members. We are one of the smallest state licensing boards in Minnesota, and yet we deal with 15,000 people. Every time you go to a concert venue or anything else, you're dealing with somebody we deal with. But our board, and I am an attorney, one of the two citizen members of the board. The board has two citizen members, a representative of the Bureau of Criminal Apprehension, who was their deputy superintendent, a licensed private detective, and a licensed private protective agent, just so you understand our little bit of our background. Our board does, as indicated, issue licenses to individuals to perform protective agent work. Protective agent work includes the things you're familiar with, like security at venues, But our statutory definition talks about providing security for persons and property. And, of course, prisoner transport involves security of the people being transported, but they also involve security of the people who might otherwise encounter these individuals should they escape or engage in, you know, things that they're not supposed to do. So the issue of whether or not people who perform this function, businesses that perform this function should be licensed, have to be licensed or not, has been one that's been around since at least 2015, where there were those who said, well, because we're transporting prisoners, we don't need a state license. Our board has issued a unanimous vote long ago, said, look at the statutory definitions. Yes, you do. And within the state of Minnesota, there are companies who are duly licensed. They're bonded, they're insured. And when you're licensed, you have to have bonding, insuring. You have to background all of your employees to make sure that they don't have a criminal record. You have to do front-end training. And if you're doing things like prisoner transport that typically involve use of restraints, handcuffs or such, you have to have additional training for your people before they start to perform those functions. So we do have companies in Minnesota that are complying with the law, that are licensed and meeting their requirements. There have been companies that are not based in Minnesota. For example, there was a company out of Wisconsin that wanted to do interstate prisoner transports, which is what the story that Mr. Legault focused on. They said, okay, we will meet your licensing requirements. Until they were able to get a license, they actually had an arrangement so they would, if they were bringing a prisoner to, for example, Dakota County, they literally would bring him as far as Prescott, meet at the, you know, it's almost like a scene out of a World War or a Cold War movie or something. They'd meet at the bridge and do the handoff to be in compliance. So there are companies that do interstate transport and intrastate transport. This bill would simply provide that to make clarity that they must be licensed. And by that license, that means if their people do the bad things that are being described, there could be sanctions and actions taken against them. Without a license, our board is powerless. We can do nothing because they simply say whatever. So this bill that we support would put into statute the requirements. It does make clear, at least we think it makes clear, that if you're a government official, you don't have to worry about this. If a deputy sheriff in Milwaukee County or wants to pick up a prisoner in Minnesota, that's a law enforcement official, that's fine. If a Minnesota deputy needs to go somewhere to Milwaukee County and pick a prisoner up for extradition or bring back, this would not affect any of those kind of law enforcement operations. The focus here is on those purely private vendors.
Thank you. Is there anybody from the public who wishes to testify on this bill? I'm not seeing any, so we can move on to member discussion. Representative Hewitt.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and I bet you're wishing I didn't come back. Real quickly, Madam Chair, to the testifier, with this system, because what I'm concerned about is, so a company has a license, right? And then within that license, even though they're accused, but this company, if I remember the report right and seeing it, had a number of accusations against them, which I would think would be a flag to be reported at least on a website. So if a sheriff is looking at hiring them, that they at least know there's some suspicious stuff that's being investigated. Is that part of the process here? Maybe I'm out of the bill realm here, but I'm really curious about that, because that's what concerns me, is that some companies can exist forever and just have, you know, tons of accusations here, but yet accusations really should be somewhere seen in the public.
And if you could answer briefly, I'm just trying to keep us on track here. Go ahead, Chair Hodgson.
Madam Chair, the whole, if they were licensed, they would be, there's a state directory. Every entity that has a license in any disciplinary action, that would put them under 13.41, which is the state licensing statute, disciplinary actions would be public record and available to a sheriff in that case. But if they're not licensed, the sheriff won't be able to find anything about them.
Thank you.
Right, any further discussion on this?
Representative Ingen.
Thank you, Chair Mueller, and thank you, Representative Tabke. This is awesome. I think we need to do this. Watching that, seeing it a couple months back when it first broke, it's heartbreaking, and it's terrifying that we're allowing that to happen. So thank you.
Anything further? Closing remarks, Representative Tabke.
Thank you very much, Chair Mueller and members. So this bill will make sure that everyone who is transporting prisoners will have to be licensed. So that will happen. Anybody in Minnesota who's transporting prisoners, and it also puts in penalties into effect if people are doing that without being licensed. So I just thank everyone for their support on this important work as we move this forward.
Thank you. And with that, Representative Tabke renews the motion that House File 4591 be placed on the General Register. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Aye. Opposed? The motion prevails. Next, we have Representative Pinto, House File 3671. And I believe that the motion is that House File 3671 be placed on the General Register. Chair Pinto, is that correct?
It is, Madam Chair.
All right, please go ahead and explain your bill.
Thank you, Chair and members. So House File 3671 would adjust the age of delinquency in the state, the age at which when there's a child who does something wrongful, that child is directed to the child protection system as opposed to the juvenile delinquency system, and changes the age from right now, the age is age of 10, raises that to the age of 13, in line with many other states around the country. I'm going to have a testifier talking about a lot of the reasons for that. I will note that the bill, in recognition of some challenges in making that switch, does have a delayed effective date of 2 years and directs several commissioners to work with stakeholders to figure out a process to be sure that we're in place to make this switch, because it is complicated, but it is something that we do need to do to line up with other states and a recognition of what's going on with young kids. But I'd like to, at this point, if I can, Chair, bring my testifier and provide some more background.
All right, sounds good. And I think you have Malaika Ebon here. So welcome back to the committee. If you would like to introduce yourself first and then proceed with your testimony.
Good morning, Chair Mueller, members of the committee. My name is Malaika Ebon. I'm the executive director of the Legal Rights Center. We're a nonprofit public defense corporation in Minneapolis. And we are strongly in support of this bill. The United Nations Convention on the Rights of the Child gives general guidance around the minimal age of criminal responsibility, which is couched in a human rights framework. The United States is the only UN member state that has not ratified this convention. In 2019, the UN committee that's focused on this topic encouraged nations to increase their minimum age of criminal responsibility to at least 14 years old and commended nations with higher minimum ages. Across the United States, ages of juvenile court jurisdiction vary from state to state. With our current minimum age of 10, Minnesota falls below the UN recommended minimum age of jurisdiction. We, as a state, have always sought to do better for our children. We can and should do better. The proposal to raise the lower age of juvenile court from 10 to 13 is an important means for us to lead through our values and follow the steps of other states across the country who are doing this work to support effective interventions for children. The majority of youth who entered the justice system in Minnesota do so by engaging in nonviolent offenses. When 10, 11, and 12-year-olds make mistakes or intentionally poor choices, it's their families and, as needed, our family-based child welfare system who are much better suited to respond than our youth justice system. The child welfare system can provide many supports that children of this age need, such as family counseling, parenting education, wraparound services, mentoring, and accountability opportunities for children to learn and grow. In more serious scenarios, as is currently the case for children under the age of 10, the child behavioral health system can provide psychiatric treatment, counseling, intensive home or community-based services, and as needed hospitalization in order to address the treatment needs of children with mental health issues, substance use challenges, or poor decision making. Not only is the youth justice system not well-suited to provide the interventions needed for children in this range, but also it turns out to be incredibly ineffective in providing interventions. Young children are very likely to be found incompetent to stand trial, and so as a result, their cases continue to be delayed and delayed without opportunities for intervention or meaningful accountability until the child is found competent. This is merely an issue of their developmental ability and not an issue of any other mental health need. Setting a reasonable minimum age for juvenile court means that Minnesota can avoid expensive and unnecessary competency proceedings and court delays that reduce the efficacy of interventions and access to justice for victims. By raising the lower age of juvenile court from 10 to 13, we are helping to ensure that when our youngest Minnesotans need help make poor choices, we're responding with the best system for the job. Thank you.
Thanks for your testimony. Any other testifiers or members of the public who wish to testify? All right, we can move on to member discussion then. Very quiet. Anybody? All right, yeah, Vice Chair Feist. Thank you, it's getting awkward.
I'll try not to be more awkward. No, thank you so much for bringing this bill. We've had a lot of conversations about it. I think it's so incredibly important. One of the things that I've really focused on since I joined the legislature and was a member for several years of a bipartisan, bicameral public safety working group was kids, because it was clear that on both sides of the aisle, there's this desire to look at our youth justice systems and make sure that they are effective and fair. And just as the mom of kids around this age, I just, you know, I think of my own kids and just their developmental stage. And I just think this is so important, and this is a really big, important step in the right direction. And it's supported by so many organizations. And so very grateful for you bringing this bill. Thank you.
Representative Hollins.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and Representative Pinto for bringing this forward. I am also very in favor of this bill, and like looking at it, it makes me think about my own 10-year-old and how she is, she won't like me saying that, just like, I was going to say she's so dumb. she's such a child, right? Like I think when I think back on youth, I think like, oh, when I was 10, I had everything. But you just don't, right? You're a kid. And it's also interesting to see how differently children are treated depending on how they look, their physical presentation. You know, my daughter is treated as if she is younger. She is like more petite. She's lighter skinned. My son, who is only 5, is bigger, he's taller, he's just a larger human being, and he's also darker complected, and people assume that he's a lot older than he is, and they treat him and they have expectations for him as if he should be behaving in a different way. Whereas my daughter got a pass for years and years and years, and they're like, oh, she's so smart, did you know she can spell her own name? I'm like, yeah, because she's old. Like, yeah, I do know that. So really, when we look at this just in the larger context, I think it is really important that we allow our kids to be kids and to make, you know, to allow them to make those mistakes and not have repercussions as if they are capable of thinking in some higher level, because they're really not. And I will, at the risk of going too far off field, yesterday was Pi Day. And my daughter's teacher was like, if you memorize pi to the 100th decimal point, you get to either like put a pie in my face, like smash a pie into my face, or eat a whole pie. And it's such a 10-year-old response. She's like, I can't wait to eat this whole pie. And I'm like, what? Like, that is, it is bananas to me. Like, you, but you are a child, right? Like, she is excited to eat a whole pie. She doesn't recognize that she gets an allowance and she could buy a pie. And like, that would be very easy to do. So I think this is really important, and I really thank you for bringing it forward. I'm excited to see it move forward.
Yeah, Representative Hollins, the question is, did she memorize it?
She got to 71. Okay. And they're giving them an extra week, because okay, apparently she got further than most. So.
Okay, all right. Representative Mueller.
Thank you, Chair Mueller. And I just want to ask real quick a clarifying question, and this is just because I've only been the legislator for, you know, this is my second year. It does say that the bill summary is a DE. I'm just making sure this is the correct one. Yep, okay. So this is the first engrossment.
Okay. Yeah, they adopted the DE in the first committee.
Just want to make sure. Just making sure that. No, I do have a question for Chair Pinto, though. Thank you. While you were crafting this bill, you kept telling us, or you told us that this puts us more in line with other states. Could you flesh that out just a little bit so that we know, like, where is this normally in other states? How? Because you're. So I just wanted to make sure what that is.
Let's see, Ms. Avon.
Thank you, Chair Mueller. Representative Mueller. So across this country, states have a range of minimum ages. Some states have no minimum age. Some states have worked in the last couple of years to bring that up to 6, 7, 8. Minnesota falls right around the national medium at currently at 10. But there are a number of states who are in that medium who are doing this work to raise that lower age up to 12 or 13 or 14.
Representative Mueller.
Thank you. Thank you, Chair Mueller, and thank you so much. All right. I agree in the sense that, you know, as a teacher for almost 20 years, I understood how important it is for our kiddos to have the opportunity to, fail in a safe place. And I get that 100%. I'm concerned right now, not necessarily because we're changing the age, that's not really what I'm concerned with, but I would like to just say that as we're looking across at some of the statistics with crimes and everything, we are seeing more violent crimes with younger children, and that's concerning. And so I don't disagree that our children need to have better wraparound services in the sense that we need to be helping them. I just want to make sure that we aren't ignoring what's actually happening, which there are violent crimes being committed by younger and younger people. And so hoping that it really is putting us more in line, I did, while you were talking, I was doing it real quick, and it looks like it's only two other states that have it to 13. So I don't know, is that what it is? It's only two other states? So it's not really making us in line. It does actually make us, three of 50 states, and so that's something that is not normal, but I'm not saying that we can't lead. I'm just saying that it's not putting us in line as normal. And if we have more and more children who have our younger kids making violent crime, committing violent crimes, I just want to make sure that we're getting the appropriate help for the appropriate crime that's being committed. Thank you, Chair Mueller.
Yep. Chair Pinto, would you like to address that?
Yeah, thank you, Madam Chair. Thanks, Representative Mueller. So grateful to you because I've had the misapprehension, and you heard me say it in the introduction about sort of where we were with respect to other states. So my apologies for that, to have that corrected. It still does occur to me, though, that an 11-year-old looks a lot more like an 8-year-old than a 14-year-old is the thinking, right? And that as we're considering how to address this, I don't view this as ignoring the issue of a violent crime by kids. I'll recognize that the spike that you're describing is in fact, or what we're seeing is in fact under the current system, right? The practicalities are, and I'd like to direct folks' attention to the, I don't think we brought this up, there's a Hennepin County page describing a pilot that was in operation, has been in operation for more than a year, and showing showing that this has actually worked in Hennepin County, but very often when young kids are charged with crimes in the juvenile delinquency system, they are found not competent, kind of makes sense, right, 10, 11-year-old kid. And so, in fact, we can't actually use that court process anyway. So the question is, how can we best get kids on a good path so they're certainly not continuing wrongful behavior, violent or otherwise? And so the thinking is that this is a much more effective way of going about that. And right now, if we have most of the kids that age, in fact, getting directed, found not competent, that's actually not really helping. Even if you assume that them being found competent and juvenile delinquency response is even effective, which I think it could certainly be argued that it's not. So this is thinking that given this age that we're dealing with, this is a much more effective approach for getting kids to have good behavior, which is certainly what we want.
Representative Frazier.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I would like to say, Representative Pinto, thank you for bringing this bill. Ms. Avon, thank you for your testimony in support of it. I know you have done a great deal of work in this area, so I appreciate when you come here, your credibility is impeccable. So thank you for that. I said this in our last committee this morning when Representative Feist brought her bill about institutionalizing compassion and thoughtfulness and how we deal with our young people. The reason I say that is because if we do not do that, the crime and the issues that Representative Mueller addressed over there, we are actually creating a cycle for that to continue if we do not do something, if we do not try a different path. The system we have in place now is not working. And so when you address issues, when you look at the overall context of why a young person may be going down a certain path, when you set a system in place to disrupt that, and then lay the foundation for a positive step forward, that is what we should be doing. That should always be the focus. And so I think this is taking us in that direction. And I don't care. Well, actually, I do care if we lead. I would prefer the lead as opposed to years from now saying we need to come in line with whatever the threshold you may be to think to be in line with those other places. So let's continue to lead. Let's continue to lay down policies that provide compassion and thoughtfulness in how we deal with our young people. And I do think long-term it's going to be better for the state of Minnesota as a whole.
All right, and before closing comments, I'd just like to say, too, that, you know, we don't do this in a vacuum. I'm looking at it, too, in the context of all the great work we did, particularly Vice Chair Feist did last year around juveniles, creating the Office of Restorative Justice, what we've seen from Yellow Medicine County as far as reducing recidivism and out-of-home placements, the grant funding that we did both for violence prevention and for YIPA grants to try to get prevent juveniles from even and kids from even coming into the system to begin with. So I look at this in the broader context of all the great work that we did last year as well. Go ahead with your closing comments, Representative Pinto.
Thank you, Chair, and thank you, members, for the conversation. And as I noted at the beginning, there are complexities in doing this. There's, you know, issues of victim notification, secure confinement when necessary, other issues. That's a reason we put it out responsibly a couple years. But it is important that we make this happen. If folks have other thoughts about kind of what that process should be over those 2 years, whether in this committee or elsewhere, stakeholders, please be in touch with me. I have a meeting on Monday with the counties and with the County Attorney's Association to raise some of those concerns. Let's have those conversations, but we need to set that target and to say that we are going to hit the target, and whatever we got to do along the way to get there, it's important that we do that. Thank you, Chair.
Representative Pinto renews the motion that House File 3671 be placed on the general register. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed? Nay. The motion prevails. The final bill we have today is Representative Erdahl's bill, House File 4101. And Representative Erdahl, I will move that House File 4101 be placed on the general register. I don't see that you have any amendments, so please go ahead and tell us about your bill.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members. House File 41 creates a definition of custodian that covers any of a petitioner's minor children as long as petitioner's parental rights have not been terminated. When a custodian exists, that person or those people, if there is more than one, must receive notice of any OFP hearing, other order, change to an OFP, or cancellation of the OFP. I wanted to make sure that an abuser could not claim that an OFP was somehow ineffective because a custodian was not notified. The language to address that is in the subdivision that begins at line 11.1. Other changes in the bill involve adding the notice and service requirements to make sure that custodians are kept informed of all filings, hearings, and orders. Now, that is the bill in a general sense. I want to go over the specific instance that is the cause for bringing this up today. And I will say that I did have earlier this week a couple of testifiers on this. Sandy Hoff, who is the grandmother that I'll be referring to, and also the aunt of the young boy in this instance. They're from Olivia. It's a long trip, and I got them for one hearing this week, and so I'm taking it myself now. On March 24th, 2022, 13-year-old Isaac Hoff was stabbed to death while visiting his mother's, Rihanna Heck's, residence. His grandmother, Sandy Hoff, had full legal custody of Isaac. Rihanna had had an order for protection placed upon her boyfriend, Houston Morris, at the beginning of March. Within 2 weeks, she had the order removed. Isaac's grandmother was unaware that the order for protection had been removed when Isaac went to visit his mother. At her home, a violent incident broke out. Morris attacked Rihanna, who produced a knife to protect herself. Morris took the knife away and slashed Rihanna. Isaac sprang to his mother's aid, standing between her and Houston Morris. When Houston had tried to stab his mother again, Isaac's mother, Isaac intervened and was stabbed in the chest. Isaac called 911 as he is lying on the floor bleeding, attempting for help for himself and his mother. With his dying words, he named Houston Morris as his assailant. Had his grandmother known about the removal of the order for protection, she would have told Isaac to stay home that night. The gist of this bill is to ensure that legal guardians providing care and support for minors are included in any updates to orders for protection. In his last words, Isaac cried out for justice. Let Isaac's voice be heard in this legislation. I do have a transcript of his call, which frankly is graphic and disturbing. I'm not going to read that into the record or any of that, but if some of you do have a desire to read it, I can provide you with the transcript from this call. So that, Madam Chair and members, is the bill. Basically, we want guardians to know if there are legal proceedings over the charges that they have, particularly orders for protection, to make sure that this type of thing, I can't say, we can't guarantee it won't happen again, but maybe somebody's going to be saved because this happened. So thank you.
Thank you. And I'm just going to see, is there anybody from the public who wishes to testify? It's pretty cleared out in here. So we can move on to member discussion. Representative Beckerfin.
Thank you, Chair Moeller. And we did hear this bill earlier this week, and I think you do a fine job of explaining the gravity of what happened and how important it is that we make this change. So you can certainly go back and watch the testimony or read the nine. I don't honestly think it's necessary to understand how important this is. You know, it's certainly out there if folks want to, but do thank your testifiers again for coming to Judiciary earlier this week. It was important to have them here and to hear their voice and have that on the record. Hopefully this is an easy one for members to support.
Thank you.
Representative Whitty.
Thank you, Chair Moeller. Thank you, Representative Verdahl, for bringing this bill forward. I echo what my colleagues say about this is an easy bill to support. I was fortunate to meet your testifiers when they came in, and just the brief moment I talked with them, and to see the pain in the grandma's face still, thinking that she didn't do enough or was responsible. So I think communication and stuff like this for these orders are very important. So thank you.
Any further member comments? Closing remarks, Representative Verdahl.
Just, Madam Chair, thank you very much for providing the hearing on this bill. And again, if just one person can be saved because we make this evident, that we make sure that people know what's happening, it's worth it. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Erdahl. I'll renew the motion that House File 4101 be placed on the General Register. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed?
The motion prevails. That concludes today's agenda. I see a couple people wearing green. Thank you for the reminder. It is St. Patrick's Day this weekend. So from this Irish gal to all of you, have a good St. Patrick's Day. And with that, we are adjourned.